In this week's programme, the role of religion in human evolution. Robert N. Beller, one of the great sociologists of our day, makes clear in his book on the subject that his primary concern is not to discover whether religion is adaptive or not, whether it's good or bad for us, but to find out what it is and what it does, and then worry about its consequences for our lives. With me, David McConnell, Professor of Genetics at Trinity College Dublin, Professor William Revel of University College Cork, who's a biochemist and columnist with the Irish Times. Paul O'Grady lectures in philosophy at Trinity College Dublin. David McConnell, let's hear your reaction to the book and what you think that Beller was up to.
Well, I mean, the first thing to say about it is it's a very big book.
Yes.
It is 600 pages long, and it has 100 pages of notes in very small type. So it's a really massive piece of work. It's written by a man who clearly is of great eminence, not somebody I had known before, but that's my fault. He's in his middle 80s, and in a way, I think this is maybe... he probably wouldn't think of it in this way, but maybe he's signing off on some great ideas.
And pulling all his life's work together.
With great erudition. It's been reviewed by Habermas and by others. It's been hailed as one of the great books. It's said that it must be on everybody's shelves. The worry is that it mightn't be taken off very often, a bit like A Short History of Time and so on, because it is so large.
Yeah. What did you make of it?
Well, right from his early days at Harvard, this man was very much concerned about the human condition. There's no question about it. He was, for example, a member of the Communist Party when he was a student. Mm. He studied Marxism intensely for his own purposes and so on. So this is a man who has been very interested in the state of the world. And I think he sees this book as a contribution of a great... mind. I mean, I'm not sure that he would say that he has a great mind, but I'm sure he has, and it's a contribution to try to persuade us that the world is in a very, very serious state if we didn't know about it, that already, and it's an effort to point us in the direction of combining together, I mean, worldwide, to try to bring people together to recognize the seriousness of the situation and the role of coming together. Bringing great religious ideas to bear, as well much as other ideas, but especially religious ideas, to bear on solving these problems.
Yeah, just before you leave your general response, his forays into matters scientific, what did you make of that?
Not much. I mean, they're very brief. I mean, there's a disappointment in the book for me, and that is that he uses the word evolution, and he defines it, of course, in a way which I can understand.
As the evolution of capacities, isn't that right?
Yes. Well, absolutely. Everything from prebiotic life all the way through to Shakespeare and Mozart and human culture. Evolution is everything that has happened in living systems on this planet. And that is fine. I too would like to think of it in those terms, but I'm not sure how relevant his discussions of evolution in biological, ordinary biological evolution, as most biologists would study it, I'm not sure how relevant that is to his larger scheme.
Okay.
Maybe a diversion, I would have thought.
Right, let's return to that. William Revel, your reaction to the book itself.
Well, I first of all echo David's remarks about the intrinsic scholarship that's on display here. It's a massive work. With massive scholarship behind it. You know, for its size and density, a relatively easy read. You should take it slowly. So he writes well. I was very impressed with the story of the grasping for meaning that he told, beginning, you know, right from the dawn of any knowledge at all we have of humanity. This was consistently there in all societies. And even from the very start, you could empathise with or identify with the decency of much of what people strived for, which surprised me that there were such intrinsic decency even in primitive hunter-gatherer situations and egalitarianism and so I was impressed with that, and it led me to the sort of ironic observation then that at the end of this long, long journey And he traces it from the beginnings of life before there was any mm-hmm. intelligence at all. At the this search for meaning. And at the present time, the creme de la creme of our scientific understanding is that the world is, as some people put it trenchantly, meaningless. You know, that we've arrived after this long, arduous struggle in pursuit of meaning. Maybe they weren't getting it right a lot of the time as to what the meaning was that's behind things. But this was obviously the most important thing throughout history, or probably the most important thing. And after all of that and all of the scholarship and the scientific understanding that we have now, a lot of the commentary is that the world is at base meaningless. There is no meaning there other than the brute fact of it.
Okay.
And its subatomic particles.
Again, we'll return to that. Paul O'Grady, your reaction to Bella's book.
Well, again, it's a very big book. It's encyclopedic, and he says himself it took him 13 years to write it. I thought it was a very interesting book. One way in which it's interesting is that in the way that it brings together discussions of evolution and religion, it's very, very different to other ways that recently have been done, say, the Dennett or the Dawkins-style approach. That is, he's much more attuned, religiously attuned, if you like, or that he kind of gets in some ways why people would be attracted to religion, what's going on there. And people like Habermas and Charles Taylor are used by him and give approving blurbs of the book as well, because they have a sense of that religion is an important element within culture, and he's a sociologist of religion as well. And one of the claims he makes is that religion is an important force in the actual shaping of cultures and the shaping of the world that it is. And he wants to explore that, but he wants to explore it using some kind of evolutionary theory in the background. And he talks about deep history. So people trying to write history going beyond the existence of texts and using scientific and evolutionary stuff as a way of doing that. And again, that's interesting because it's bringing into at least dialogue the scientific and the humanistic. And he talks about that as well. And also, I think that I agree with David that I'm not convinced on the detail of the evolutionary story as he tells it. That almost evolution is more like a metaphor, as he uses it, rather than meaning something specific that occurs within biology. But that being said, I think his account of religion drawing on the prehistory, so drawing on anthropology, drawing on ritual, etc., is very, very interesting. And I think it's quite illuminating, describing the different kinds of religion and the role that religion might play within a society. And I think he's very convincing on that.
You mentioned the egalitarian behaviour component there, William. And I was struck by one thing where he talks, David, about the emergence of egalitarian behaviourists. And he talks about Christopher Bohm's Hierarchy in the Forest, which I'm sure is a work, you know, the evolution of egalitarian behaviour, written in 1999. And Bohm explains the egalitarian character of hunter-gatherer societies, not by saying that such societies had got rid of dominance hierarchies, but they have reversed dominance hierarchies. In other words, they have devised ways of stopping the person who wants to control. And then the story would appear to be that when you moved out of that kind of tribal society to what he calls an archaic society, or a more state-led one, that you had the collapse of that, and we got into an era of despotism. That's very interesting, sounds rather clouded to me. But William, what did you make of that?
Yeah, I found that very interesting. A lot of this thinking was fairly new to me, so I found that interesting. And I was also very struck by the explanation for the emergence of the family in human society. Now, I knew about that before, but I hadn't ever thought much about it. The human baby being born more and more immature, and therefore demanding a longer and longer period of care under the mother, and that setting up this bond and the nuclear family. And the baby being protected for so long allowed the baby the freedom to play. And he makes a big, not to make a pun on it, play on the importance of play. And he comes to it in the
conclusion. Forgive me, he says that.
In the conclusion.
When did religion begin? He says it begins with play. Mammalian play. How did that strike you, David?
Well,
too speculative?
It just took me into areas of thought that I really had never been before. I'd never thought of it in these sorts of terms. and I was a bit puzzled by it, and so on. And I don't think I really fully understood it.
Religion. Just think of the idea. Religion begins with mammalian play. How might that be, Paul?
Well, he discusses a number of different frameworks within which to think about this. One thing that he emphasizes is that religion is not primarily theory. So religion is not
practice. It's doing it.
It's practice, but even in certain ways, even more primitive than practice. He says there are certain basic human capacities that emerge, including one that was really interesting. He talked about the uniquely human capacity to dance. At one stage, he talks about that is it requires a certain capacity to move your body rhythmically in a certain kind of way. And these are the origins of ritual. So there's a certain naturalistic or certain biological imperative that leads one to act in this particular way. And it's that on which religion piggybacks. So there are certain types of things that we're almost hardwired to do as the kind of mammals that we are. But then you get this layer of ritual, myth and meaning built on top of it. And one of the crucial claims is that the higher levels don't obliterate the lower levels. Mm. So even though you might have a theoretical superstructure, there still is myth and there still is what he calls an active, that is very, very basic kind of things going on. Now, as a way of thinking about religion, the claim about that is that a lot of people approach religion as something that's purely cognitive or something that has to be either accepted or rejected. Whereas a lot of recent work within philosophy and people, say, influenced by Wittgenstein, want to talk about religion as an anthropological thing, as something that plays a role within culture, and that affects people's emotions, their meaning, their sense of where they stand within life. And sure, there's a theoretical dimension and people can argue about that, but the thought is there's much more going on there in the background. And I think Bella's really good in just outlining some of that and saying what goes on there. And doing it in a very, very cross-cultural way.
And yet his broad schema, I mean, you know, where he says, talking about societies that move from tribal to archaic, you know, the beginning of a state of some kind, to what he calls axial societies. And in axial societies, which we've had roughly from about 500 BC, are defined by the primacy of theory. In other words, a world where reflection begins. So that would seem to run counter slightly to the point you've been making.
This is something that I've just never thought of. I'm not familiar with the field at all. And you know, coming to it, I discovered rather towards the end that this idea of an axial age. Came from somebody called Carl Jaspers, who I should know, but don't. And it seems to have been an age during which several of the great, what we would see today, several of the great religions of the world went through an extraordinary phase of consolidation, of theoretical development, I suppose. Wondering about the world on a very large scale. And it does seem that he points to it, that this has emerged a little earlier, that so many of the ideas which emerged in these great religions in China, in India, in Greece, in Israel, those are the four that he chooses to discuss in great detail, that they were all, broadly speaking, coming up with very similar ideas.
Yes.
And I was fascinated by that because when I was at school, I remember being introduced to a book by a friend of mine, and I think it was entitled The Five Great Religions of the World. And the wonderful thing about this book is it explained how similar they were to each other. As if independently in many different regions of the world, and this goes back to tribal, the emergence of tribal societies, because of human nature, if we can put it that way, human social, familial developments, came up with the same sort of general ideas as to how they could deal with and think about the world around them.
Yes.
And I found that interesting. So this axial age of 2,000 years ago, approximately, and as he says in the beginning of the book, he says, I don't go anywhere, I don't go beyond that. So he stops then.
How do you mean stops then in the sense? I mean, he's really saying that's the world we live with. And at one point he says that the world we're living with is in some way the intersection of the Israeli world, the Judeo-Christian, and the Greco-Roman. He's saying that's the kind of world, William, that we live in.
Well,
yes, Paul.
Well, one of the things he did say earlier was that he could have gone there, but it would have been a much bigger book again.
So
he's left Christianity and Islam aside, though he said his discussion of Israel should illuminate some of that. But following up on David, you know, he talks about these axial religions and he does emphasize some similarities, but he also pushes the particularities very, very strongly. He says, there's a lovely phrase where he says in terms of religion, you know, whereas everybody needs a home, there's no home in general as a kind of a thing that exists. You don't have this pan-universal thing that you can work. So he's very interested in the cultural specificity, the historical specificity of the religions as they appear. And also his discussions of each of the particular ones, and they're lengthy, 80 to 100 pages each. They're very illuminating discussions. So he has new things to say about Plato's myth of the cave. He relates it to Buddhism in a certain kind of way. He talks about the life of the Buddha. He talks about a lot of these axial figures.
But before going into that, I mean, that's our world, isn't it? I mean, that world of 2,500 years ago, that's the world we're living in. There has been no major shifts, William, since then. Yes?
Take William first, please.
Yes, I see what you're saying, Andy. We would be basically in a continuation from where he stopped on this side of the...
With more data, David, of course.
Well, let me quote one really beautiful statement. He says, "Our technological progress is geometric. It would be hard to argue that our moral progress is even arithmetic. I cannot see much in the way of moral advance," he says, "in the last 80 years of which he's been..." Now, what is... You may well be right. I mean, Andy, I think you're right. Yeah. We're living in the age of 2,000 years ago in a religious sense.
But also in the sense of theoretical sophistication. I mean, in other words, that we have more data, but in terms of the way we process that data...
In terms of the kind of things that he's talking about, there's a realm in which he has very sophisticated things to say about, say, technology or evolution. But the bigger picture kind of questions, that is, so the story that the Buddhists tell. So there's an ethics there. There isn't an associated metaphysics. The Greeks tell a story. So there is some kind of a metaphysical story there. How do value relate to this kind of metaphysical realm? And one of the big debates in the contemporary world, I think, is how exactly does this whole discussion, and so the kind of stuff this book is about, how does that relate to the world of science? So there's a lot of sophisticated advances obviously happening within the realm of science. But what does that have to say about how we understand values, how we understand human meaning, and how we understand human destiny? And what kind of discussion is that going to be? And it seems likely that whatever discussion is going to be, it's not exactly going to be a scientific discussion. It's going to be some kind of meta-discussion.
But have we advanced beyond, you know, a world of theory and reflection on theory itself, which is what he says defined what happened at that time? Have we advanced beyond that in terms of broad structural cognitive terms? I don't think we have we?
Very little, I think. And it's very difficult to advance quickly. Mm. I mean, there is this geometrical progression in science and technology, and that has become easy after certain watersheds were breached in these areas. So it's relatively easy for science and technology to advance very quickly now and to bring up all sorts of problems to which there isn't an ethical answer or a quick one. And then to sort of criticise the traditional ways of deliberating on these things as being outdated. But from where are we going to get ethical considerations?
But you see,
we can't get them from science because it's not the business of science to do ethics.
This is, I think, a fascinating question. I'll tell you why. Because you hinted there, David, you know, in saying about the lack of moral progress, in a way saying religion always has to be presented before the bar of moral judgment. In other words, religions themselves can be destructive or creative. So you're talking ultimately in terms of some kind of moral evaluation at the end of the day, aren't you?
The axial age figures, as he describes them, so people like Socrates, the Israeli prophets, Confucius, etc., they're all social critics, is one of the main things that he wants to say. Mm. And most of them came a cropper or didn't. So Socrates is killed off by the Athenians, the prophets are stoned or whatever. So they're, and he characterizes them, he uses this term coming from India, of the renouncer. So that is someone who stands back from the culture and actually critiques it internally and has fairly sharp things to say, but particularly about social structure. And even in the Indian discussion, very interesting discussion of the Upanishadic and the Vedic backgrounds and where Buddhism comes along, Buddhism puts ethics foursquare. So the discussion, the previous discussions were much more mythological, cosmological. But the Buddha says, look, suffering is a pervasive human phenomenon. What do we do about it? How do we deal with it?
And the Buddha's picture is rooted there. But you have the question, though, that William was raised there. Then even if you assign primacy to the ethical in terms of our horizons, you can then ask, what's the source of our ethics?
The source of our ethics? Well, okay, first of all, it is tradition and custom and practice. Where do we get our ethics? We get them from our families initially.
Who may have got them from religious traditions.
Well, possibly, yeah. But the role, I mean, one of the things which he says very early on is the notion that you could have religion without the supernatural. His concept of religion is broad enough exclude the supernatural.
I think that's right. Yeah, he quotes Clifford Geertz and he gives this definition of religion.
Says, forgive me, that Maslow talks about it in terms of sort of what he calls be cognition, where you have a kind of a heightened consciousness. In other words, where you have a sense of participating in reality. And he says that you can make distinctions there between having, you know, a heightened sense of the world and some sense of there being a beyond, in which case you're into the religious domain. In other words, you can look at nature, have a heightened sense in responding to it. You're in some kind of religious or quasi-religious dimension, but it's only when you move to the sense of there being a beyond that you're in the religious domain proper.
There's a sense where, atheists and naturalists can have the sense of all or a sense of the transcendence of the world. Mm-hmm. And some of my philosophical colleagues will describe themselves as kind of pantheistic atheists. You know, they'll say the religious response is completely appropriate, but there isn't any such thing as a god. What Bella says that I think is interesting is he says, look, what people say is within this religious realm has varied a lot. And so the division between powerful beings, gods, and this monotheistic conception of God is a development. It varies across different cultures. So what people actually put in there can vary in different ways. But what's constant is this sense that the function of the realm of religion seems to play an important role in terms of giving people meaning, giving some kind of an environment for morals and ethics. Mm. But I think I disagree with David a little bit in terms of where the ethics comes from. There's a sense in which tradition does give you ethics, but all these axial peoples criticize the tradition, they challenge the tradition, and they come at it from somewhere else. Where does that somewhere else come from? Well, I think in some ways that's where philosophy comes in. So philosophy proposes different ways of trying to understand the foundations of ethics and gives a rationalistic case for each one. It may be from the hardwiring of the human brain, okay? It may be from our culture. It may be from some notion of duty that's a transcendental, as Kant says. But you have a lot of kind of fairly sophisticated argumentation trying to back up each other's things.
People will ask you, what are the origins of that critical capacity itself, as you well know?
It seems to be human self-reflection, and that's precisely
yes,
what
but
this
people
book
will
is
ask,
about.
What are the origins of it?
Yeah. Can I go back for a second, Andy, to something that Paul was talking about? I mean, the biggest question, one of the biggest questions we face today is, can we have ethics and can we have morality which is rooted in something which is not supernatural? That's, for me, a crucial point. And when I gave a rather brief answer to this question, where do we get our ethics and where do we get our morality from? Well, we need to distinguish between the ordinary, dare I say it, the average person thinking, living, facing up to the ordinary problems of life. How do they get their behavior? Where do they get their standards from? And these are, by and large, people don't think a great deal about these matters. They actually behave, broadly speaking, the way their parents did and so on, their society does. They're strongly influenced by the tradition which is around them. Now, what we are going to try to move towards, I would have hoped, is a sort of situation where, there is a great deal more thought, a great deal more reflection encouraged in school, in society, in general, where people are introduced to some of the great ideas from philosophy, where there are rational explanations given for the moral stances on a great variety of different questions.
I think that's right. Yeah, I think that happens as well when tradition breaks down.
Yes.
So when the monolithic picture breaks, and that's what all the axial figures are about, they're within a position of ferment where they're beginning to kind of reflect on these issues.
You should ask William's thoughts on that.
It may well, of course, and it is possible to have ethical reflections and opinions and conclusions based not on religion or on the supernatural, concepts to do with the supernatural. However, the great majority of people are still affiliated in some way to religion and are going to draw on these traditions to decide on ethical matters. And we would want to be careful not to try to put that in some sort of old-fashioned way of thinking about it.
No,
this.
But I think David's question was, can you have that kind of ethical reflection and behaviour without a religious underpinning?
Oh, yes, you can, yes.
That's progress.
Well, pardon?
That's progress.
Yeah. Well, not really, in the sense that I certainly think Aristotle had a lot of ethical reflection. It wasn't at all explicitly religious in any particular way. So this idea that ethics has to be absolutely tied to religion isn't there. And I think even, you know, religious thinkers will take that on board. They have their religious beliefs, but they have this kind of sense that perhaps you can root your ethical view in human nature or some kind of counter-human psychology.
He's very much a religious pluralist in the end. You know, no one tradition is superior to another. Bella.
Absolutely wonderful. Yes, I think the last few pages, the conclusions, are really wonderful.
Because he's a pluralist, how did you react to that, William? Did you find that congenial or not?
I found his conclusions sort of veered off, for me anyway. They veered off the smooth backbone of the book. And I think he made too much out of the play. And he jumped all of a sudden then onto global warming and are we going to destroy ourselves before any...
But this idea of pluralism specifically, I mean, the idea that no one tradition is superior, would you accept that?
Broadly speaking, yes. Yes, I would, yeah.
You would? Yeah. So in other words, you don't see that the Christian tradition to which you belong is inherently superior to other traditions, no?
Well, for me, it makes the most sense. But I wouldn't go to the stake in trying to convince you about that.
I really applaud his pluralism. And as a philosopher, I have real problems about the way that he articulates it. So there's a sense in which he skates over issues around truth in a way that's fairly woolly. So at one point, he talks about symbolic truth. And how, of course, all these different traditions have symbolic truth. And I'd like to find out what does he mean and what's the relation of symbolic truth to regular truth insofar. So there's a lot of recent work, and it's the area I work on myself in the last 10 years, on relativism, pluralism, and he just ignores that area. But he says things that I like the punchline, but I'd like to just know much more about the machinery of how he gets there.
Yeah. His main schemas, I know, are ultimately cognitive in character, aren't they? The different stages of knowing the world.
Yeah, but I think what's really nice about him is that he says it doesn't double literate the earlier stuff, so it doesn't write off the mimetic or the earlier or the primitive. Yeah, that's still there.
They're all important. Absorbed in that, where you move to this kind of theoretic high stage. We've been discussing Religion in Human Evolution from the Paleolithic to the Axial Age by Robert N. Bella, published by Harvard University Press. My thanks to William Revel, Paul O'Grady and David McConnell. You can listen to the programme again on our off-the-shelf website at rte.ie and on the RTE player. Till next week, bye-bye.